On FM, on DAB, and up to date on social media. We are Radio Newark. Radio
Newark. Hey, 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 Kevin Guthrie here, talking all things mental health and well-being. Thank you so much for listening to another one of our podcasts. As always, we have a guest in the studio today. We have John Fretwald. Thank you, John, for being here.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thanks, John. I'm going to start off with a listener question, as we always do. So the listener question was, somebody asked me the other day what CBT was. So CBT stands for Cognitive Behavioural Therapy. CBT, or Cognitive Behavioural Therapy, is a type of therapy. The basic model of CBT is we think, we feel, we behave. So everything starts with a thought. From thoughts, feelings are created. From feelings, behaviours are created. So imagine for a second that your thinking is very negative, it's very detrimental, it's not very kind to yourself. You may then start feeling down because of the thoughts that are happening in your head. If you start feeling down or low, your behaviour will reflect that. Might reflect in by way of not feeding yourself very well, not by not going to the gym, by drinking too much, by doing other things that we know are unhealthy for ourselves, without there being some sort of balance there. So we think, we feel, we behave. If you recognize that your behavior is off and you're behaving in a way that you don't like or doesn't become you, then trace it back and work out what's happening in your head. So that's what CBT stands for. John.
Hi.
You sent me a message as I put out a shout out for people to record these podcasts, and you said that you would very much like to be here. Why was that?
Well, it was an opportunity. I'm still receiving treatment, NHS treatment for a mental health problem. Let's just put the big bubble around mental health. I've been on a journey, both in first experiencing the symptoms of a mental health problem, and then hiding those away for a lot of years, and then as the symptoms get stronger, really understanding that it's a problem, but not really having any idea how to tackle that problem whatsoever, and then finally to moving towards really admitting that I've got a problem that's affecting the quality of my life, the quality of my wife's life, the quality of everything around you. Mental health is a very personal problem, but it's also a wider problem, because what I found was the more I struggled to cope with the symptoms of my mental health, the more I damaged those around me, the people that I love and the people that I care for. And I got to a point both with mental health and an alcohol addiction problem, where I felt that it was almost at a point where I had to do something or really either seriously damage myself or seriously damage those around me, and I didn't want that to happen. So I'm now probably in towards the third lap out of four, I would imagine, of understanding my own mental health and understanding what I need to do as a person to keep that under control, and to understand the triggers which cause mental health from being stable and happy and joking to the point where I'm sat in a front room on my own, crying for 4 hours for no reason whatsoever. And that's a horrible symptom, and it's a horrible place to be.
Yeah.
And it's even more horrible not knowing why.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of talking to friends, family, and professionals. And I'm also on medication from the doctors, which helps me cope. So that's where I am now.
What was for you, and I'm asking this question because I'm going to assume that it's going to resonate with a lot of people. For you, what was the moment that you recognized that something wasn't right or that you needed to take action?
Okay, that is an interesting question. The point when looking back, I can now realize that something wasn't right was actually much earlier in my life.
Yeah.
I can look back at symptoms that I was feeling and actions that caused me to do, and go, really, John, something wasn't right in your late 20s.
Yeah.
One example was I'd been on a night out with friends, had a really good night, got into the home, couldn't sleep, and walked to the park at 3 o'clock in the morning and sat on a park bench until 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. On your own?
On my own.
Wow.
On my own. With no build up, it's been a really bad week. Just got home, couldn't sleep, and for some reason, I had to get out of the house and I sat on a park bench in the middle of the dock for 5 hours.
Wow.
For no reason whatsoever. And then when I came back, I was relatively disorientated, rang a girlfriend at the time, and she rang my mother, and my mother and father came round and kind of brought me back into the real world.
Yeah.
And then I forgot about it. You know, you've had a wobble, something wasn't right.
Move on
and forget about it. But by any standards now, I look back, that isn't what I'd consider to be normal behaviour.
Yeah.
Something's triggered that, I would consider, again, to be a very unusual reaction.
Yeah.
After a good night out with friends, really enjoying yourself, isolating yourself on a park bench for 5 hours.
Yeah.
Not normal.
And also, you know, slightly putting yourself into a moment of danger there where you were on your own outside.
Yeah, so, of course, absolutely. But I wasn't thinking about that. And then the point, skipping forward 15 years, I was a relatively well-paid a director of a company, and I had all the benefits that came with that in terms of salary, healthcare, nice new Mercedes on the drive, and career was going really well. I was earning very good money, and that was a positive benefit to me and my wife because I was earning good money. And I lost my job, you know, out of the blue. One day was called into the managing director's office and we're making some cost cutting and you're going. And that was very tough. And then the financial problems weren't a problem initially.
Yeah.
The severance payments plus savings that I had with my wife meant that I didn't need to get a job straight away. So I took some time off and did the garden. But the point it really kind of hit home was when they turned up and took my car away.
Yeah.
They literally turn up at your house and take your company vehicle away. Yeah. And it was like, oh, okay.
This is real. Yeah.
That's it. I'm no longer at home, pottling around the garden, effectively living the life I was living before, but just on holiday.
Yeah.
Now it's real.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning, I think, for me, of when it all my mental health issues seemed to get very, very real as well. And that was probably, I think that was about 3 or 4 years ago. And that was very, very hard for me.
Yeah.
And I didn't have, you know, my job was not just a Mercedes and a good salary and traveling abroad for your job in business class. My job was who I was. It's a very big part of every person.
You.
It did. It defined me.
Yeah.
You know, I was fortunate enough to be relatively academically bright, sailed through school, sailed through an engineering apprenticeship at a company called Rolls-Royce, was promoted very, very quickly and reached a level where I was very, very comfortable financially and doing a responsible job. And I thought I was good at what I did.
Yeah.
And to have somebody go, you know, and I've since had the conversation with the managing director of the business that I work for and kind of just said, why me? You know, it was a very big question in my head.
Why me? Yeah.
Why me? You know, why don't you talk to me about it first? Why don't you come in and say things aren't going right? You know, all of these things that are going around in your head. And I met him at Birmingham Airport, actually. It was, and I kind of asked him, why me? And he just kind of shrugged his shoulders. Well, it had to be somebody, you know.
So it wasn't about you not being good enough?
In my head, it most certainly was.
But not from him.
He didn't say that.
Right.
But
okay.
but in my mind it was probably an uncomfortable conversation for him to be having. He was still working at the company that I used to work for, and he happened to be caught up with me in a bar in Birmingham Airport, and he couldn't get away. And that really affected me in terms of my self-esteem, how I felt about myself. I was always, you know, looking back, really rather dismissive, really, and arrogant about people who had mental health, but who hadn't achieved what they wanted to in life.
Yeah.
Whereas I saw it was only hard work that's got me there. No, nobody, I didn't come from a rich family with parents.
Yeah.
I went to a comprehensive school in a small village in Derbyshire, you know, and went straight into work at the age of 16 as an engineering apprentice at Rolls-Royce. And I didn't see how people couldn't get to where they wanted with hard work. Now, looking back, I can see there's an element of luck in that. There's an element of right place at the right time, personalities, finding a particular manager who liked me or sort of something in me at younger. All of these things were happening around me, and I had no real understanding of how they were affecting my life, but they were. So my job was an incredibly important thing in my life. Aside from my daughter and my wife and my close family, I would have put that right up there. And losing that, the first symptom was I had a bit of time off and inevitably started to drink more alcohol during that time. So I wasn't at work. There wasn't a reason not to have a beer at 12 o'clock. So all the time mentally I'm trying to deal with the devastation in my mind of losing my job, which had taken away who I was. But also, my reaction as a person was even more destructive. It was hiding in alcohol, drinking myself, so to forget, as they say, just using it more, using alcohol more and more as an escape, just to try and get away from, you haven't got a job anymore. I eventually found a job at a similar salary and working for a competitor, actually, of my former firm. They contacted me and said, well, we know what you used to do. Will you come and do it for us? And I said, yes. And I did that for 18 months. And then they kind of put the pressure on me to say, we need you to spend more time in China. We need you to spend 6 months of the year. And I said no. And if they say, you do understand, if you say no, we will make you redundant. And I said, I understand that. Wow. And they made me redundant.
It's a big ask.
It is a big ask. But it was kind of... the thing at that kind of level, the higher you go, the more you're expected to suck it up. I'll get plenty of people to do your job, but you've got 10 senior managers who'll snap the hand off to be in your position, and you don't want it. So I left, and it was at that point that I started to have thoughts of self-harm. Really going to my GP and saying, give me some help. And it's at that point that I found, and I know we've got a wonderful NHS service that's under a tremendous amount of pressure. It's at that point I found there is no one-stop shop for mental health. No. I was expecting to go to a GP, be prescribed some medication, referred to a therapist, referred to another person. It doesn't happen. The NHS doesn't do that anymore. They will give you the name of, in my case, the alcohol advisory service in Newark, who did great work and really helped me, but they don't work for the NHS, they work for the council, and they've just been moved out of their new office, their big offices down there. There's nobody to help you with what are you feeling. They'll prescribe me some pills, and they talk in very broad terms about fill your life with the things that make you happy, which is easy to do if you're happy. It isn't if you're tremendously depressed.
Oh my goodness.
And it took me a long time to get used to that. I'm now, we've opened a second shop. I'm a small business owner in Newark and sole ladies, where we've opened a second shop that I run in the summer months, and in the winter I just get a part-time job at minimum wage. And it's not glamorous, but it pays the bills. And I'm still on medication, quite strong medication, but my relationship with my wife has never been better. My relationship with my family has never been better. I don't drink at all and haven't done for 7 months. Not that anybody who wants to have a drink can have a drink, and I know I can as well. I could leave here being the Wetherspoons and have a drink within 7 minutes of leaving here. I just don't want to anymore. And that's the change in mindset that I've noticed in myself. And really what I wanted to speak to you is, mental health can happen to anybody. And for me, I had to hit the lowest point I could hit before I got better. Before I started to see myself get better. And that was kind of my journey to where I sit here.
I always think it's such a shame that... I'm a therapist, so I work with people that hit rock bottom, and then they come to me and say, I've hit rock bottom. But sometimes I'll get people, I get a lot of couples that'll come through the door that'll go, love it when they do this, you're our last chance, this doesn't work, we're separating. I'm like, oh, goodness, why did you leave it till now? Why did you have to hit rock bottom? And I'm really hoping that part will change, where people will go, I don't feel so great. Something's not right here. I want to go and talk to somebody. So they haven't hit rock bottom, and then they will step into whatever that support network is. It doesn't need to be a therapist, whatever it is that that works for them. And I am seeing that shift where yes. people are coming and they're going, yeah, I just don't feel right. I don't feel right and I don't like it. And I feel like I'm on the edge of something that is going to take me downwards. So I want to work out what that is now before I start going down. And for me, that's really powerful when we can do that. So we're kind of being more preventative, because then you know what they said to you when they said go and do stuff that makes you happy. If somebody's at that point where they haven't dropped, they be nice to yourself, or self-care as we call it, is usually a little bit easier.
Yes. But
if you've dropped, self-care isn't even there. You can't practice self-care when you're at the bottom of a pit. You just can't do it.
No, you have, you know, certainly there are so many little things that I could talk about. For example, I live in an area of Newark where I can be in the town centre within 5 minutes by yeah. car, less than that. And I used to give my wife a lift to work because she obviously sometimes has to carry bag, cardboard boxes, things that aren't easy to walk with.
Yeah.
And the stress of driving into Newark, 2 minute drive, dropping her off and driving back really hurt me.
Yeah.
In case the car stopped and I had to get out of the car.
Yeah.
I didn't feel safe until I was back in the house.
Right.
In case I had to talk to somebody.
Yeah.
In case I had to pretend to be fine.
Yeah.
I was at the point where I could no longer do that. I could only be myself in front of my wife, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah.
Parents, no. You know, put a smiley face on the phone.
Yeah.
Make them think everything's okay. But even a small thing, like driving into town and driving back,
yeah,
it was almost, I felt better. The moment I locked the door, I felt better.
Yeah. Safe.
Safe.
Yeah.
Exactly that.
Yeah.
I felt safe. I could be myself, watch something on TV and just try and be calm.
Yeah.
And that was a terrible place to be in, you know, where you're almost at a stage where you can't face people.
I talked on a previous podcast about being biologically wired to connect to other people. And we are biologically wired to connect, to look each other in the eye and be able to talk to each other. So then when you end up in a place where that part there fills you with dread and fear, that's, like you say, it's not a great place to be.
No, it's horrible. It's really, really unpleasant.
How long would you say that you were in that place for?
2.5-3 years.
Wow.
At least a long time.
Yeah,
a long time. It took me a long time to make the decision for myself to try and cut out all of the things that could potentially be causing me mental harm.
Yeah,
the first and biggest was alcohol.
Yeah,
so let's cut out alcohol. It's not going to hurt you, and it might make you think clearer. You know, because alcohol's got, it's a depressant.
Yeah.
It's got chemicals in it that are doing things to your mind.
Absolutely.
Well, let's keep them out then.
Yeah.
And let's give the mind some clear space to try and work with.
Yeah.
And that was the first stage. And things didn't immediately get better. You know, I get questions from my mum. I was with all of my family yesterday in Derby for my mum's housewarming. And my brother-in-law asked me, do you feel like you've got a lot more energy since you've stopped drinking? I go, no, I don't.
Yeah.
Physically, I don't feel any different.
Yeah.
Mentally, I feel a lot different.
Yeah.
Mentally, to anybody who listens to this podcast, I'm on an even keel.
Yeah.
I'm on an even keel. I'm sailing along a calm sea.
Yeah.
I'm taking medication, but at this stage, that's fine because I'm sailing along a calm sea. And if the sea gets a little choppy, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Because I know it'll be calm in a little while. I don't know yet if I'm strong enough to cope, if there's a force 10 gale,
yeah.
You know, maybe I was to lose my mother or something like that to death. How would that affect me?
Yeah.
I don't know, but I'm certainly in a better place to cope with that.
Yeah.
And kind of be strong and navigate yourself through those tough times in life that you have to do. You can't just back away and say, well, I don't want any of it anymore. Yeah.
No, I always think that life, one of the most profound things I ever read was, life is tough. Once you accept that life is tough, then it gets a little bit easier.
Mm.
And I think what the author meant by that was, if we think that life is going to be a bed of roses and it's going to be wonderful, then we are going to be sorely disappointed, because life will throw stuff at us all the time. You might get a flat tire. You might. It could be the smallest of little things, like we were talking about off air, but it's how we navigate those. Yes. How we navigate those things. But I experience a lot of fight in people when they go, I don't want a flat tire. I don't want to have a flat tire. Why have I got a flat tire? And I just go, just roll with it. It's just a flat tire. Yes. Of course, if they're in a bad place, then it's not just a flat tire.
No.
But I do feel sometimes that we fight life way, way, way too much, that it becomes uncomfortable. Sometimes when somebody ends up in front of me and they're depressed or they're anxious or whatever it is that they presented with, one of the first things I try and do is get them to accept it. And that's really hard, because people do not want to accept that they're depressed or that they're anxious or that they have some mental issue. And actually what I'm trying to do is say, no, the first step is to accept that it's there, that you've got it. And then what we do is then we start working on it. But whilst you're fighting it, we can't work out how you're going to manage it.
No, absolutely.
Because it's like a physical fight with something that's there.
It's interesting you say that. You know, denial is a very big part of and not just mental illness as well. You know, I've got a very good friend of mine who was a very fit young man, and I played football with him at junior level, and you couldn't hurt him. And he kind of ignored an illness that wasn't a mental illness, it was actually a physical illness, and ended up dying very young because he kind of ignored it for too long.
Yeah.
And he was a very strong man, you know, physically big, very tall, very strong, and unfortunately, you know.
It took him. Do you think men do that more than women? It's a massive generalisation.
It is a massive generalisation.
But do you
know,
think?
The women that I know really well in my life, both my sisters, are very, very strong women.
Yeah.
And I've no problem giving you their opinion.
Yeah.
They're very vocal. They're not, you know, not afraid to stand up and be counted.
Yeah.
My wife is also a very strong woman, but in a completely different way. She's very creative. She's very artistic, very intelligent, but not in the same way. And she... I feel when I first met her, almost expressed very, very little negative emotion at all in her life.
Yeah.
You know, she was a very positive person.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd go 6 months without even a crossword. And I do mean that,
yeah.
You know, without even, not an argument even, not even a crossword. And I think as my wife Katie is, she's had to live through my problems. She's learnt, I think, to be much more direct with me.
Yeah.
When I'm behaving unreasonably.
Yeah.
And the thing with a mental illness, or from my own personal perspective, is the biggest problem, certainly in the early stages, you don't realise you're behaving unreasonably. You think you're behaving perfectly, logically. And why could this person not agree with you? And why aren't they doing what you want?
Yeah.
Well, because they have an opinion of their own, and maybe you're not right.
Yeah.
And you, for myself, I became to recognise that more. And she's got a lot better of telling me when I'm unreasonable.
Yeah.
And we've had a long chat about, let's not make small problems big problems.
Yeah.
You know, my favourite glib off the cuff, nobody's died.
Yeah. No. I love that one.
Yeah. You know, I use that all the time. Don't worry about it. Nobody's died.
Yeah.
Is, you know, if you don't ring that particular supplier in the shop right now, is it going to kill us?
Yeah.
Well, no, it's not. Well, then don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Finish your dinner.
I think years ago when I had my own stuff going on, that was one of my phrases that I picked up on, and I used to look at a situation and go, is anybody going to die? So the question was, is anybody going to die? And if the answer was no, then I would just then let it go. I would just go, okay, then it's all right, because nobody's going to die. That question doesn't always work, but it will work an awful lot of the time. Because although we do experience loss, it's not an everyday occurrence. So ask yourself that question: is anybody going to die if I don't do that? If I don't call the supplier?
Yeah.
If I whatever it is, and put it back into perspective.
Yes, it's for me starting to get better and starting to understand my own mental health and understand the triggers that happen that make me start to feel unstable. a big part of that has just been I did a course of hypnotherapy with a very talented guy in Grantham, and part of what he made me understand was you can't control other people's behavior.
No,
you can never control it, never ever. All you can control is your reaction to that. And during my mental health, I was real bad problems. I was having a particular problem with my teenage daughter. She was about 14 or 15 at the time. And we just couldn't connect on any level.
Yeah.
We just, every time we talked to each other, we rubbed each other up the wrong way. From my perspective, every bit of press I was getting about her was negative.
Yeah.
Be it from her teachers, her friends, her mother, who we separated, we divorced from. You know, everything was negative. I couldn't see a positive thing in our relationship. And because of that, the time that I spent with her reduced and reduced and reduced because there's no point in seeing it, so we're doing argue. And hypnotherapy actually made me understand better that I can't stop her. She's a teenager. I can't stop her going out with her friends. I can't stop her experimenting in drugs and tobacco or alcohol or whatever she's doing. And I don't know if she's done any of those things. But the worry of her doing those things was affecting me.
Yeah.
And she will do. She will experiment. She will have boyfriends. She'll have sexual intercourse with people at some point.
Yeah.
And she's now 16, nearly 17, and she's at college, and she got fantastic results in her GCSEs, which I never expected. And I learned that don't try and control her. Just be nice. Give her support when she needs it, and let her know support's there so she can ask for it. And I don't do any more.
Yeah.
I don't pry into a lot. I'll make fun of going, oh, is this your boyfriend? A photo on Facebook or something. But nothing more serious, though it would mortify her to know she's being talked about today, so I won't name her. And it's that kind of thing that I really got a grip on. I actually went to hypnotherapy to try and stop drinking, which partially worked, but it worked much more in my relationship with, and we did a lot of work on my relationship with my daughter, and my relationship with my ex-wife, which was relatively, had got to the point where it's relatively fractious.
Yeah.
Arguing about money, arguing about who pays for what, all the kind of things that anybody who's been married and then divorced will understand. And it helped me understand that less is more in that situation. If you can't say anything positive or add anything productive, don't do anything. Just let it, don't feel you have to stick your oar in. It's not good parenting to be constantly the one that is adding tension and friction into a relationship.
It's not healthy, is it?
It's not healthy. I just stopped doing it.
To any parents that are listening out there and you're going through something similar with teenagers, as John said, we don't stop by adding pressure. All you can do really is keep the door open, let them know that you can come to them, and let them know. For me, my daughter's 24 now. Yeah, 24. I always tried to make sure that there was a door open and that I would talk to her about alcohol or drugs, or gave her a box of condoms once, because I worked in sexual health. And I just so happened to have a box of condoms in the boot, so I gave her a box of condoms and I went, here, take these. And if you need to talk to me about anything, then you know where I am. I'm always good to talk to. But again, it feels like that was your... You know, as parents, we get desperately worried over what's going to happen. And if this happens? What if that happens? And then we go in with this unfiltered approach of, I'm just going to hold her and keep her tight and then nothing will hurt her, but... It's again unhealthy, isn't it?
It was my relationship with my daughter is kind of one of the real positives from the journey that I've been in.
Yeah.
Because I'm very, as I mentioned earlier, academically, I'm quite gifted. She would bring homework to me and say, I'm really struggling with my GCSE maths, Dad. What do I do? And I'd look at it and go, well, you do that, that, and that.
Yeah.
I might as well have told her to paint the Sistine Chapel. She has no understanding of what I meant or how to get to what I meant. And it used to cause me tremendous frustration when I was really quite ill.
Yeah.
You know, we'd have literally screaming at each other down the phone or on FaceTime on how to answer a math question on a GCSE paper. I was so frustrated that she didn't get it. I can do that in my head in 2 seconds. Why can't you?
Yeah.
Why can't you do it? with no more logic than I can do it, so why can't you?
Yeah.
Which is completely unfair. You know, she can probably run 100 metres quicker than I could run 10 or something like that. But in this particular thing, mathematics, I couldn't work out.
Yeah.
And I've tried and tried. I had no mechanism
to communicate
with her that this is how I'd approach it, which is ridiculous because I used to do some part-time maths tuition for other GCSE students. I know the syllabus. I know how to teach them, but I couldn't do it with my daughter.
Yeah.
It was too close. It, you know, if you're working with a student and you know them and you like them, but you're not really part of their family group, you can tell them when they've done something wrong and just keep doing it over and over and over. With my daughter, I expected her, not just wanted, I expected her to get it straight away.
Yeah.
And that she couldn't caused a tremendous amount of friction between us.
Yeah.
Really, you know, if I could play back some of the conversations we've had on FaceTime about homework, it'd shock you. And people would listen to it and think, oh my God, imagine having him for a parent.
Yeah.
And but that was tough.
What feels like was missing there was, it feels like you were talking different languages to each other. It doesn't feel like you were doing anything particularly wrong, but it feels like one was talking English and one was talking Spanish, and there was like no connection in the middle of that.
There was no connection. And because of my mental illness, we talked earlier about big things, small things becoming big things.
Yeah.
It was a question on a maths paper. If she got it wrong, so what? Yeah. You know what I mean? And she actually did pass a GCSE maths without my help or whatever help I thought I was giving. So that I was no help whatsoever. But in what I've learned to look at is, in the grand scheme of things, is it really worth falling out with your 16-year-old daughter about?
Yeah.
A maths question on paper? Of course it's not. Is it really worth her not wanting to come and see you because she's worried we'll get into an argument about something? Of course it's not.
Absolutely. John, thank you so much for coming in today. We have just about come to the end of our time. Is there anything that you want to, any final message that you want to leave the listeners with today?
Absolutely. Please talk to somebody.
Yeah.
You know, if you start to uncontrolled bouts of rage, uncontrolled bouts of anger, uncontrolled bouts of sadness, you know, I don't want anybody there. Talk to somebody. And there will be somebody you can talk to, and I'm sure you can put people in the right direction of places they can go.
Yeah.
Talk to your family. And that was the hardest thing for me because I was the eldest son. I had a father who was a strong man. I believed I was a strong man, and emotion was for wimps. It isn't. Everybody's got them. No matter how hard you try and hide them, pick up the phone and talk to your mum. Pick up the phone and talk to your best friend. Talk to your sister, talk to your brother, talk to your daughter.
Yeah.
Be reach open out. And honest and reach out, exactly. Yeah.
Thank you so much for that. Just to back that up, it's about literally just reaching out to somebody. And if that somebody doesn't give you what you need at that point, then reach out to somebody else. There is always, always another way, but we have to start talking about this more and more. John, that was really frank, really honest. Thank you so much for sharing that.
No problem. It's been a pleasure.
If we are covering subjects that you want to hear, then that's brilliant. But if we're not, then please, please, please let us know. Let us know the subjects or the areas of mental health that you want us to talk more about. If you want to take place in one of these podcasts, send me a message and I'm sure that we can sort that out. We are looking for people that have stories. We are looking for people that have experience in this area, whether that be professional or personal. Either way, if this podcast resonates, then please pass it on to somebody else. Let them listen to it as well. Please share them on Facebook. I'm going to go now. So remember, as I always say, please, please be really, really kind to yourself because you are worth it. Take care. Bye-bye.